This is talk show host Charles Goyette, author of The Dollar Meltdown, and it's a pleasure to have a few minutes to speak with a congressional candidate from New Mexico. Adam Kokesh is on the line with us today to share some views with us, give us a little bit about himself, and a few minutes about his views on some of the issues as well. I've known Adam actually for a couple of years and spoken to him in the past several times on the radio. So, Adam, it's a great pleasure to talk to you again.
Hey, well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you, as always.
How's the race in New Mexico?
Well, of course, as candidates, we're all conditioned to say, it's going great.
Yeah.
But really, we've had a lot of people who are really new to the process on the team here, which is something that, you know, that I did intentionally. And it's very exciting to see now that we're really getting drilled down to the last 50 days leading into the primary. We're getting everybody really focused here. And I don't know if there's some other catalyst for this, but seeing that some of the shenanigans the Republican Party has pulled against us, you know, considering they had to put up one of their shills to run against me, has really got our volunteer base just so motivated and energized. We've got people organizing volunteer meetings on their own on the far corners of the district in Clovis and in Farmington, and it's just incredible to see that this message is resonating with people here and inspiring people here, just like, you know, we saw in Ron Paul's presidential campaign, and it's motivating people to get involved and participate in the process and bringing people in who, you know, previously might not have even voted.
Who's the incumbent in New Mexico's 3rd District there?
The incumbent that I'm running against is Ben Ray Lujan. He is the son of the Speaker of the State House here in New Mexico, and since being elected, he's voted with Nancy Pelosi 99% of the time. He's a freshman. Last time I checked, he was not elected by the people of San Francisco. And the people here in New Mexico's 3rd District definitely deserve someone of an independent mind who's going to represent them and listen to them in a way that really Ben Ray Lujan has been absent as a member of Congress. You know, he's had the sort of typical, where he'll call it a town hall when he sits in his office for an hour and says, you know, a dozen people get 5 minutes each with me, and he shows up 30 minutes late.
Right.
Or they have town halls where they're busting Democrats in who aren't going to ask any challenging questions. He's really not getting out there and listening to the people. There's a lot of dissatisfaction here. People want someone who's going to listen, who's going to vote with an independent mind and really represent them better than he has.
What do you represent as a threat to the Republican Party establishment that they would have to find somebody to oppose you and to drain votes off of you in the primary?
Well, the whole left political spectrum as we know it, as it's developed in the United States, I mean, doesn't even really serve people well in terms of how most people think of the left-right concept. But in the ways that the parties have come to represent that, they've really been based on who their sponsors are. You know, and the Democrats have sponsors in unions and pharmaceuticals and, you can name it, a bunch of different industries that benefit from certain large government policies. And then in the Republican side, you have certain groups that benefit from the large government foreign policies or the large government police state policies that sponsor that. And when you challenge their sponsors and say, no, we're going to make the party really stand for what it believes in, what the base of the Republican Party really believes in, that's the Constitution, individual rights, limited government, a foreign policy that's constitutional, that has us, you know, allows us to go after our real enemies without getting the politicians in the way and keeping us out of this, you know, ridiculous nation building that we're engaged in now, and this policing the world that I was a part of as a Marine serving in Fallujah in 2004. And so we've seen that our message really resonates with the grassroots, really resonates with the base. They see that a message like this can bring people together and win in this difficult district. But the Republican Party leadership, you know, there's a certain xenophobia there. They'd rather have someone they're comfortable with and lose than have someone that actually has a chance of winning representing them as their nominee.
Well, I know a little bit about your service in Iraq, but tell me about the process that you went through in that period and kind of your awakening about the destructiveness of this foreign policy.
Well, I was against the war before the war, you know, as someone who was at least intellectually engaged, as opposed to philosophically or spiritually, you know, in the political process, and knew that it wasn't going to be in our best interest, but I felt that I had a duty to serve as long as there were troops in harm's way, as long as I was able, and that what we were doing afterwards was cleaning up our peace and responsible foreign policy and really genuinely trying to do good by the Iraqi people. I served as a sergeant on a Marine Corps Civil Affairs team in the Fallujah area from February to September of 2004, and found out for myself that wasn't the case. that these, you know, and then I started asking questions. I couldn't find any good answers. You know, I started asking questions about the premise of the war, about why we were there, about what, you know, how the justifications for the war weren't being lived up to by the policy itself. And, you know, I came home and I was dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was very frustrated and I started speaking out in it. But it wasn't until I got out of the Marines that I really got active, standing up for veterans, especially free speech for veterans and for active duty members, and being able to be empowered to be a part of the political dialogue rather than being choked out of it by military restrictions, and making sure that veterans are taken care of when they get home. And part of the way that the global war on terror was sold to us was that it wasn't going to cost anything. You know, this whole strategy of denying the cost of the war has had a really disastrous effect on veterans, because there was never any plan for taking care of the troops when they got home. And George Washington said that the measure of the willingness of future generations to stand up and defend this country will be based on how we treat the veterans of today. And when we have a quarter plus of the homeless men in this country as veterans, and we've lost more veterans to suicide than we have to combat since 9/11, clearly we are failing on this. The war did not pay for itself with the oil, as we were told. And, you know, anytime the government, any government official tells you, hey, it's going to cost this much, you're pretty safe to triple the estimate. And I think if most Americans knew, you know, what we were paying for our occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan right now, it would really wake people up, especially a lot of the true conservatives, you know, the real base of the Tea Party, who are, you know, very much against taxation and government spending and big government, you know, to realize that our foreign policy has become just another big government boondoggle.
What do you see as having been instrumental in the awakening of the people? I know that you're spending time with Tea Partiers and gatherings of that sort in New Mexico, but where do you trace this newfound dissatisfaction to the blow-up of the markets in 2008? Was it to the bailout bills? What do you trace it to, Adam?
Well, actually, I was part of the organizing team for the first Tea Party rally here in Santa Fe, and I've been helping out with the movement since then. And I still get requests to speak all over the country, you know, some on foreign policy issues, sometimes for Tea Party groups and constitutional-oriented groups or libertarian groups. But I'm staying really focused here. And, you know, what I've seen here is sort of what's backed up, you know, my theories and my approach to politics in general, which is that in order to get people involved, you have to reach inside their bubbles. And it's hard to do that, you know, as an individual who wants to get people more involved and show people how policies are affecting their daily lives, because we've been conditioned and propagandized to stay in our little bubbles, you know, like it was said in Network, you know, leave me with my TV and my steel-belted radials and my microwave and just leave me alone and I won't say anything. And people, if you want to get them involved, you either have to reach into their bubbles yourself or show them how current government policy is reaching in. I think that's what's waking people up, is that people are seeing their daily lives affected, you know, and this is why our government gets away with so much in foreign policies. It's very easy to create a disconnect. And I think we've seen the evolution of that from Vietnam, where they were pretty open about it, and people saw the horror of war up front and direct, and they had the body counts on their TVs every night. Well, the only time we hear about the global war on terror, really, is when the government is doing some, you know, beautiful press event and you know, trying to spin it to their narrative, whereas the realities now are coming home. People are seeing how the economy is being affected and how jobs are harder to attain here. And I think that's what's doing it. It's that the daily lives of the American people are being affected by these policies. As the government takes on more power at the expense of individuals, more individuals are going to be pissed off, and they're going to be getting in the streets. And I think that's what we're seeing. They're going to get engaged in the political process, I hope. But, you know, in a lot of the ways that the anti-war movement was co-opted by the Democratic Party and various liberal front groups, we're seeing the same thing happen with the Tea Party now.
Oh, yeah.
And the 2006 election was largely a referendum on the war. And Nancy Pelosi, January 2007, she could have ended it then and there, or at least started that process. And she didn't. And it's the same thing like we saw with the Republicans in 1994 when there was that, you know, backlash against Clinton's first year in office and the contract with America. Well, they only enacted one of the 10 planks. of the contract, and that's really shameful. So I'm really hopeful that as we see the Tea Party kind of going through the same thing that the anti-war movement went through, that they're better engaged in the political process. They're demanding, they're being a little bit more engaged in the primary process, I think, within the Republican Party, to make sure that candidates that really know, that really have a smaller government platform, based on real principles.
Well, I hope you're right, Adam. I want to tell you, out here in Phoenix, Arizona, where I live, they had one of the first big Tea Party movements at the state mm-hmm. capitol, big gathering, mm-hmm. and one of the people they invited to speak, and this was called in response to the bailout bill. And I don't mm-hmm. remember if it was Bush's $700 million or the subsequent Clinton ones, but one of the guys they invited to speak was an incumbent congressman who had voted for them.
Oh, man.
You know, and just so it seems like there's a lot of confusion on the part of the people about these things that they don't pay a lot of attention.
There's that popular sentiment, that uprising, and as, you know, seems to be the case, the political machines that have the money in the organization are able to co-opt it to their ends.
Yeah. Well, let's talk practical politics. Adam Kokesh is sure. Sworn into Congress, and what do you do about containing our economic problems? It's my view that it's much bigger than Congress, but how do you at least begin to approach it?
Well, I don't know if this really gets to the bigger issues, but I've taken a salary pledge that I won't accept the standard congressional salary of $174,000, but only the national average income.
Well, that's a good symbolic start, Adam. I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, and it is largely symbolic, but I think it shows you who's in it for the right reasons. It's going to make it very clear. You see it. You might see a handful of. I'm going to take the balance of every paycheck that's above the median household income, as determined by the Department of Commerce, and donate it to a charity that serves the people in my district and let them choose which one. But, you know, I will submit that as a bill as well to peg all congressional salaries to the national average. And that's not something I'm going to push. I'm not going to expect, you know, a whole lot of people to jump on board with that. But I think I'm going to give an opportunity for people to see who are the real ones that are in there for the right reasons, that are there because they want to serve the people as opposed to themselves, the, you know, party insiders and special interests. So, now, like I said, I that's a bill I'm going to submit that I really don't expect to get a lot of support or get passed. But what I'm going to direct my efforts towards isn't, you know, achieving my ideal, but finding the things that really bring people together in the way that there's that divide between Washington and the rest of the country, and create rallying points in legislation. For example, I mean, look at Ron Paul, you know, submitting a bill to end the Fed every term he's gotten in, not getting anywhere with it. Then he does H.R. 1207 to audit the Fed. The timing is right after these bailouts. Next thing you know, he's got over 300 co-sponsors. I'm going to be working to find rallying points in legislation that we can bring people together around on. For example, I'd like to see the Federal Reserve ended entirely. I'd like to see us return to a sound monetary policy, a constitutional monetary policy. But realistically, what can we build consensus on? What can we build a coalition on that's going to make real change happen? For example, Section 13-3 of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 is the one that Bernanke has invoked to conduct these bank bailouts in secret. Let's take away that specific power. I think if we can do that legislatively, and we can really rally people together around that. I'm going to be looking for things like that. I'm going to be looking for everything I can to cut spending, things that we can rally around. And for example, the Department of Education, you know, it's let's send someone to Washington who has the guts to say, I'm pro-education, and that's why I'm for the elimination of the Federal Department of Education, because it's a bureaucracy in Washington that sucks up money, passes down unfunded mandates, is really destroying our educational system, as we've seen particularly through No Child Left Behind. But it doesn't run a single school, and it doesn't educate a single child. And I think if I'm in a position to make that pitch to Congress and to the American people, I think there's specific things like that we can rally people around on. You know, the oil and gas industry is a very big deal here in this district. And, you know, while I think the EPA is in and of itself unconstitutional, I don't think we're going to be able to fight for the elimination of that. But what we can fight for is to localize a lot of the functions of the EPA, restrict some of its powers, make sure that it's really doing things to preserve the environment and not just manipulate the economy. But the big thing there, and this is, if anything, the theme of this campaign and what I'm going to be pushing for as a member of Congress is localism. You know, of course, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Congress doesn't have the explicit authority to do those things, but a lot of people have come to really rely on those. I don't want to pull the rug out from underneath anybody, but I don't want these programs to continue in an unsustainable way where we're burdening our children with an incredible debt. Let's localize them. And it almost offends me that there's no Republicans talking about this constitutional solution on Capitol Hill, which is let's return the authority and the responsibility for all these programs back to the states, where they can either be phased out or they can be adopted or adapted to actually serve the people they're intended to serve. They can be more transparent, more accountable. And if states or communities want to have programs like that, they can be done in a way that serves the people they're supposed to serve and are done in a sustainable way.
Adam Kokesh, a very thoughtful and plain-spoken candidate for Congress, New Mexico's 3rd Congressional District. Adam Kokesh, the web address is kokeshforcongress.com, K-O-K-E-S-H, kokeshforcongress.com. Adam, it's always a great pleasure to speak to you, and best luck in the campaign.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Adam Kokesh, special thanks to him, and thanks to Freedoms Phoenix, freedomsphoenix.com, for making their studios available for these conversations with candidates. I'm Charles Goyette.